You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, and we've got a really cool episode tonight. We've got Jeffrey Lewis, who wrote the song that opens every single Punk News record freakout LPs. He's got a brand new record out. It's really cool. I've heard it. It's called The Even More Freewheeling Jeffrey Lewis. It's out March 21. We're going to open up with a song, and we'll come back and we'll talk to Jeffrey. This is the lead single, which has a cool video as well. This is Sometimes Life Hits You.
Nicer than some folks had. Could have a family that you make that isn't so bad. Well, you can build up your armor against what life brings. You can dodge when life kicks, and you can duck when life swings. You can outsmart all sadness and outfight with the best. But sometimes life hits you like a chisel to the chest. And you say, ow, fuck, that hurt. Something sometime that makes you feel like you're dying. You're gonna have yours, and I'm gonna have mine. Could have a nice home with flowers and cool modern loot. Sweet job, short hours, and an easy commute. Could have a partner, feel lucky, with best love and wishes. Cute kittens and puppies and tropical fishes. Well, you can quote from philosophers or Bibles or songs that find hope in the hopeless and find right in the wrongs. You can wear art and wisdom like a bulletproof vest, but sometimes life hits you like a hammer to the chest. And think of all the words you could say at that time. You'll think of all the poems, you'll think of all the languages and fancy words and grammar ever invented by the human tongue and philosophy and poetry. You'll think of all the paintings, wars that have happened to theoretically make life better, all the technology, all the religions. But when that thing happens, that gets deep in your heart, well, forget about it.
And we're back. Jeffrey, thanks for being on the show, man. We're really psyched to have you on the show. How you doing?
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be part of this. Thanks for playing that track. And yeah, good to talk to you guys.
So, Jeffrey, the new album, what I like, it's got the whole gamut of emotions. And I'm going to slightly paraphrase actually the opening track, actually, I think. And you say something like, if I just acted natural, I'd put my head in the oven. And I'm like, damn, like, do you really feel that way? Or is that just how you feel sometimes? Or how are you feeling right now? I mean, it's presented in almost a whimsical fashion, but it's like it's almost like a rudimentary penile level of heaviness. You know what I mean?
I often have this sense of not knowing if my songs are like pessimistic or optimistic. There's I don't know what has made me that way, but at least somehow I'm still here. I feel like things were certainly worse in my life earlier in my life, and I look back on songs that I wrote when I was in my 20s or at certain phases, and I'm glad I'm not there now. So I can definitely say that, it's hard to, as an artist, you're kind of representing yourself through the whole range of all the different thoughts and emotions that you've had, and you may be gripped by a certain perspective for a period of time, whether it's an hour, a day, a week. And the stuff that you make that's coming out of that passion, then maybe the next week or the next month or the next year, you're in the grip of some different passion or you think of some other perspective. But that wouldn't make me want to disrespect the version of myself that was passionately engaged with the thing that I was making last year or 10 years ago. So I think over the course of these things, yeah, there's all these ranges of emotion, and from humor to tragedy to philosophy to playfulness. And I try to just get the range of all the buttons in myself that I can push.
You spoke about how things have improved, at least in your perspective, since you were in your 20s. And you talk a lot about that on the song 100 Things, which I really like. But I guess my one of my main questions is, what's improved that has given you, I guess, maybe a more positive mindset, or at least the ability to address the content of a more positive mindset?
Oh, man. Happy pills. It's been about a year and a half since I started popping the happy pills. And they have me on a thing called a paroxetine or some other thingamajig. I don't even know what it is. It's a generic form of some other something or other. And I don't even take the full ones. They assigned me these pills, and I just chop them all in half with a knife. So I double my supply of happy pills. I just take a half a happy pill every day because I figure if I'm just half happy, that's better for my artwork. But it's been... yeah, probably a year and a half now, or going on close to 2 years, that I've been eating a half a happy pill every day, and it's had a wonderful effect on me. So I can't say I would necessarily recommend it to everybody, and I'm sure that everybody has to find their own concoction. I had at some point earlier in my life tried these like anti-anxiety meds, and that, I don't know if that really helped me much. I tried that for about a year. I'm not like a super pathologized person in the sense of saying that I have a certain ADHD or a certain OCD or a certain this or a certain that. I just feel like maybe I've been prone to some emotional edges that I would rather just kind of grind down a little bit of those edges a bit. And it seems to me that in the past couple of years, some of the worst edges, I feel like I haven't experienced that in a while. And it can't be a coincidence that it's these little half happy pills. I'm like, maybe they actually work. So or maybe it's just maybe I've just had some good tours in the last couple years, or maybe I'm happy about my new album or my new comic book, or I don't know. I've got a girlfriend currently. Maybe I'm happy about that. That's kind of been an on and off thing, but it's on currently. And who knows? Whatever it is, I do feel like I look back on the way I was feeling a few years back, or certainly at certain parts earlier in my life, and I'm like, man, I'm glad I'm not feeling that way now.
I got one more question along that line. I thought I'm going to ask you about 100 things to track. And actually, I should mention, if you're already a Jeffrey Lewis fan, the new record is awesome. It's got some rocked up songs. It's got some of the folky songs. It's got some of the really depressing ones. It's got some really funny ones. The new one, dare I say, tour de force of Jeffrey Lewis. It's a real cool new record. You definitely should. I mean, I think it's great. One last question along those lines, and let's bring it back to Rudimentary Peni again, one of my very favorite bands that I'm going to push on you. You said that I take a half a happy pill because I'm worried about it affecting my art. Nick Blanco of Rudimentary Peni has expressed that same concern, but I think this new record is one of your sharpest records. So is that a concern? Certain medications influencing the creative process, with the creative affecting the creative process.
I'm not sure, but I can say that I never expected to be making recordings 25 years into this whole thing of making songs. I started doing this stuff when I was in my early 20s. So I made my first recordings when I was like 22, started making up songs and playing at open mic nights. I was never a musician prior to that. And at every step of the way, I always thought I was all washed up from one week to the next trying to come up with something to play the open mic. I remember feeling like I was totally out of things to say. And, by 1999, I was completely washed up and I should just quit and go back to making comic books. And then in 2003, I was like completely washed up. I'll never make a good song again. And then somehow I made a couple other things I felt good about. And then in 2007, I was like, oh, this is definitely the end. I haven't come up with a good song. And, so the fact that here I'm able to say, well, look, here's a batch of songs on this record. And I'm happy about putting this record out. And I even have a couple of songs, a handful of songs that I've written since then that I feel like could be worth playing to people. I write a lot of songs, and a small percentage of them are ones that I feel like are worth people hearing. But I don't know what has affected, things that have affected me one way or the other over the last 25 years of doing this, all sorts of circumstances, from better times, worser times, up all sorts of ups and downs in every sort of way that happens over the course of a person's life of a couple of decades. And somehow through that all, every time that I thought, whatever circumstance I'm in, it's definitely the end of me as an artist because, God, the last six songs that I wrote are just real stinkers. The last 20 songs that I wrote, there's just nothing of value in that. I'm never going to write another good song again, or nothing that excites me again. And the same thing artistically, drawing in my sketchbook, I'm just like, oh, God, I'm just cooked. Forget it. I just suck. But you just keep on pushing through, and somehow, whatever the circumstance, you can't predict where the next thing is going to come from. And then at this point, I've just been going so long that I have felt completely at the end of my rope, completely convinced of that so many times that at this point, I just feel like the next, every time I feel that way, I'm like, I guess if it wasn't true the last 20 times I felt that way, maybe it's not true now.
Exactly along those lines is near the end of the record. There's this cool track called 100 Good Things, which I really like. Interesting about that track is all the other tracks are studio tracks, but that's a live track. So the first question was there a specific choice to make it alive for some reason, or you just like that recording? You say, we'll just leave it live and not do a studio, or what's the idea behind that?
I think I did have a studio version of that song, but maybe I sort of changed a couple of the lyrics at a certain point, or I, for whatever reason, there's actually another not the there's a song on the album called Just Fun that's just a home recording as well. It's a solo acoustic recording, and you can even kind of hear me click on the recording device at the beginning and the end of that song. If there's this little like schmutzy click that's in the audio there as I'm just at home doing that solo acoustic thing. There are a couple reasons why I liked doing the putting that live version of 100 Good Things on the record. And actually, I did have a friend of mine, my old drummer, Dave, who was my drummer for many years. I played him a version of the album when I was first getting it ready for reproduction. And he was like, "Why is there this live track in there? That kind of messes up the whole flow of the record." I'm like, "Why is, you know?" But I just liked putting it in there because, for one thing, I tend to record all of my gigs because a lot of times I have new musicians in the band. I actually have a brand new bass player in the band right now. I was just rehearsing with an hour ago. Because people are always coming in and out of the band. It asks a lot of people to, you know, go on tour, and I don't expect people to stay in the band forever. So there's often, you know, there's a new drummer, there's an, you know, whatever. And it's very helpful because I have a lot of songs that I want them all to learn how to play. Because we do different sets every night, and I'm always like, "Well, let's try this song, let's try this song." So I find it very helpful to record the sets, and then in the car the next day, as we're driving to the next gig, we listen back to the last night's performance, and then we can be like, "Here, that part that you did on the bass right there, like, that was really cool. Like, why don't you, next time we play that song, why don't you try doing that again?" Or somebody's like, "Oh man, I really messed up this song," and then you listen to the recording from last night, and it's like, "No, that actually sounds fine. Like, you didn't mess that up." Or you can point out certain, you know, it's real, especially if you're learning new songs or trying to teach a new band member new songs, or if I'm trying to memorize a song, it's very helpful to just listen to the recording. So I end up at the end of a tour, I do end up with a bunch of these kind of, you know, live bootleg things on my laptop or on a recording device. So I just wanted to throw that one in there. I thought it was a nice performance of the song, even though I do stumble on a couple lines. I actually forgot a lot. There's a whole lyric that I left out. But there was just something about the audio of it. I liked the fact that it sort of put you in this other space. And I like a kind of mishmash album that's coming from a few different sources. I think a lot of my albums, there's usually some sense of a little bit of a mashup. And I love records like that. I mean, I think of one of my all-time favorite records is Perverted by Language by The Fall. And that record has a mix of, some of it is demo stuff, some of it is live recorded, some of it is studio tracks. And it just creates this multifaceted listening experience of, here's just what this band was up to during the few months when this record was being put together. So yeah, I can't really overthink it that much. It just made sense to me at the time to have that live recording on there.
The track kind of talks about good things in your life, or how you've achieved more than you thought you would achieve, or you've got a little bit of money, which is a nice thing to have, you know. One of my favorite lines in that song, you're like, "I'm a small, but I'm a, it's like I'm a small or smaller, but I'm a fixture of countercultures," or a line, something like that, where basically you say that you are a fixture of a certain cultural scene. And
I'm a small but thriving cultural fixture.
there you go. So
I oh, the line is, "I'm successful beyond anything I was something like, I'm successful beyond anything I could possibly picture. I'm a small but thriving cultural fixture."
And so M is kind of tired of hearing me ask a version of this question, but I really like how you say, "I am an important creator, at least in this space." And a lot of guys and gals in rock and punk and indie, they're like, "Oh, well, I'm not that humble," with this, you know, faux humility. Whereas hip hop guys, like one of my all time favorite, KRS-One or James Brown or George Clinton or Prince, they're all like, "I am the best. I'm the best." So I always like when rock guys kind of say, "Yeah, what I do is important, and I'm pretty good at what I do." So thank you for, I guess, having some sense of self awareness and set, and no bullshit. What I'm saying is, you think what you're doing is good, and you tell people that, which I like. I like that there's no bullshit there, is what I'm saying.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it would be interesting to try to write a song or try to make more of a positive overall album. That could be an interesting experiment. One thing that's interesting about rock versus hip hop is that in rock or folk, you don't tend to say your own name that much in the lyrics. I think that there's some interesting things that could be done with people saying their own names in the lyrics more, because that's definitely a thing that's I associate with hip hop more than other genres.
And I agree. I think it should be done more in rock and punk. I think that there's a lot of room there. Because people love when people like Rancid. Not that I'm a huge Rancid fan, but Rancid is always singing about being Rancid and Lars and Tim hanging out, and people love that. So I think more rock bands should sing about that kind of a thing. You know, the cover. Well, speaking of a level of self-awareness, the album is called The Even More Freewheeling Jeffrey Lewis, and it's an homage to the freewheeling Bob Dylan, in title and in album cover. Of course, Bob Dylan's famous album cover has him walking down, I think it's 4th Street in New York or East Village, something like that.
Yeah, it's in the it's West 4th Street and Jones Street. He's on Jones Street almost he's sort of on the corner of West 4th Street.
And you, as you and your female companion, I don't know who this lady is here, reenacting the scene, except for you're totally naked. So the first question is this a Photoshop job, or were you actually down there on 4th Street, au natural?
Yeah, we were naked, but what I thought was my intention of the joke of it was supposed to be that the original Dylan album cover, which was shot in February 1963, and when we I was recording my album in 2023. It's just taken like a year and a half for the album to finally come out, and actually it's not even out yet. I mean, you've got access to it, but there's only been one single release. That the full album doesn't come out until March 21st, 2025, which sounds like quite a long ways from 2023 already. But my intent, I just had this funny idea, like, what if I do a 60th anniversary thing of the Dylan album cover from 1963 to 2023? And because he and his girlfriend, Suze Rotolo, were looking rather cold and chilly, Dylan's got his hand jammed in his pockets. He's wearing this, like, leather, he's try, you know, he has this coat that doesn't look like it's heavy enough. And they're walking in the snow, and I thought, well, what if I could find some friend of mine and do this photo naked walking in the snow, so that, like, you know, that would be even bolder. But it just happened to be the case that from 2023 and 2024, there was just no snow in New York City. So I kept trying to find somebody who could take the photograph and somebody who'd be willing to be in the photograph with me on a snowy day. And there just was never a day. It was really 2 years of kind of no snowfall of any real significance in the city. The woman who did the photo with me is my old friend Chrissy, and I had emailed a number of friends to see if anybody would be willing to try this crazy photo with me. And Chrissy was the only person who was really enthusiastic about doing it and was like, it has to be me. I would totally love to do that. Like, let's totally do that. And but then it was just, you know, we never did find a snowy day, and it almost ends up sort of accidentally being a comment on global warming or something that, like, we tried to, it was 2 years with no snow. Now, actually, there has been snow this winter. If I would have just waited, but it's like too late. I had to get the album into production, and everything has been gone to manufacturing already, because in New York City now, there's actually been a couple of snowfalls this winter. So I did just do a video shoot. I shot a video this last weekend where I'm playing a song standing on Jones Street with no clothes on in the snow. There's a little snippet of it. I only sang like one lyric in the video that made it in there, because I was just like, hey, it's snowing. Let's run out and, like, try to get this shot, just so we can get that in the video, so we can get a little snow. But it was an actual, you know, it's an actual photo. We did it early in the morning so that there wouldn't be that many people in the street, but of course there were still a few people walking around, but it's New York City, so people are used to seeing everything. Nobody gave us any hassle. We just took a bunch of photos, picked what we thought was the best one, and got out of there.
So is that a compliment or an insult in that, you know, you're walking around naked and no one really cared? Like, was that cool or was that disappointing? You know what I mean?
We didn't know if we were going to get in some kind of trouble
Yeah.
or if we were going to get shut down. And it was, it because it was tricky to get all the elements to align in terms of when Chrissy was available, when my photographer friend was available, and, you know, we had to try to make it work pretty quickly, and we didn't know if we were somebody was going to yell at us or if somebody was going to hassle us. So it I'm glad that we were able to get it done, but I mean, it's a pretty obscure street. That whole street only goes for one block. So it's not a very busy street, which is probably why Dylan did that photo there in the first place, that you can walk down the middle of the street and there's not many cars going by. It's a pretty sort of esoteric, quiet little street. So it's still a pretty quiet street, even 60 years later.
Well, Jeffrey Lewis, the wild man of rock and roll, the new record's pretty cool. I got a couple last questions for Jeffrey. Then we're going to play a song and come back and do some news. This isn't directly related to the record, but you a while ago you did a record where you covered all Crass tunes, and some Crass, not some fans of Crass were upset by it. But then about 6 or 7 years ago, someone was talking to Steve Ignorant about it, and they were like, "Can you believe this guy did this?" And Steve Ignorant said he thought it was really cool. What? Well, how'd that feel to know that you got the official Crass stamp of approval? That'd be pretty cool, right? Or is approval meaningless with regards to Crass because there is no authority but yourself, if you will?
Well, yeah, that's you could look at it that way for sure. I was at the time when that album of my covers of Crass songs came out. It coincidentally was at the same time that there was a Dirty Projectors album where they did all reinterpretations of Black Flag songs, and it was just and speaking of those sorts of coincidences, like I was saying that my new record has taken about a year and a half to come out. It's just a coincidence that my record is coming out now that there's all this Bob Dylan stuff in the air because of the Dylan movie. So everybody is like talking about Bob Dylan all the time. And now it's like I have my record coming out. It kind of looks like I'm jumping on the bandwagon. But really, this has been my album's been in the can for, over a year now. We did this photo shoot last year and it was a. Just coincidence that it happens to come out during a little burst of Dylan mania. And the fact that I did these covers of Crass songs at the same time that the Dirty Projectors put out an album with Black Flag songs, I remember hearing that the Black Flag members were very kind of nonplussed by the Dirty Projectors record, or they hadn't communicated with them, or they hadn't heard anything back from the Black Flag folks. But by contrast to that, and you might almost expect people that were in Crass to kind of be a little more friendly or personable than people that were in Black Flag. But I had a lot of interaction with various Crass-associated people because I was touring England with my band when that record came out. And at various gigs, different people were coming to the shows. Steve Ignorant came to see us play in Cambridge. That was just incredible to me. I couldn't, and he said hello after the show or something. And that was like, whoa, wow, that was Steve Ignorant. And in London, Eve Libertine actually got on stage and did a poem with us. Did a poem on stage while we played some like improvised backing music. That was incredible. I mean, her vocals on the Penis Envy album and all the Crass stuff. I'm just like, it's some of my favorite stuff. It's so mind-blowing to me. I'm just such a fan. I couldn't believe that we got to cross paths with her and have that interaction with her. And then we did a New York show around that time, and Phil Free and Joie de Vivre came to see our New York show. So yeah, that was just so cool to me that these various people who had been part of the Crass project were just curious, and they were just coming to shows and coming and saying hi and being pretty friendly about it. Whether they actually liked it or if they were just curious about it, that none of them were like, "That was amazing! I love that you did this." But they were all just kind of like, "Hi, cool." It was like they were just coming by to, and that was obviously cool. And then I never did Penny Rambeau, who was kind of like one of the main focal characters in Crass and the drummer and wrote a bunch of the lyrics. He never did. I never saw he. I met him at some point a couple years after that at he was doing an art gallery thing in New York City, displaying his artwork, and I went to that event. So I met him there just briefly. I guess I said, like, I'm the guy who did that record, and he was like, oh, that was interesting, or something like that. So yeah, they were all super cool. And actually, I got to see Steve Ignorant play a gig in Brooklyn a couple years ago, or maybe about a year and a half ago. He was on tour doing all Crass songs, and that was spectacular. That was just such a amazing killer performance. I'm so glad I saw that. And all of his stuff, I've been very impressed with all the Steve Ignorant stuff that I've heard. Even his recent albums, the songwriting is great. It's a very different style. It's much more kind of gentle and folky almost, but very powerful. And yeah, just I just feel so lucky to have had the chance to interact with any of them.
That's real cool. I mean, it's always fun to hear the Crass crew. They're like they are who you think they are, which is always a lot of fun. Jumping
Yeah.
back to a couple last questions about the current record, the even more free-reeling Jeffrey Lewis out March 21. At the end of 100 Good Things, you talk about how there's so many cool records, and the whole song could be about cool records. I love collecting records. You've got the song LPs, which is a little bit of an older track. What are maybe one or two or three of the crown jewels in your personal collection? Are you still collecting? And if so, what are just some of the crown jewels in your collection? Not necessarily money-wise, but meaning-wise, or just like to have-wise, anything like that.
Oh yeah. Totally. Well, I mean, you're a record, anybody who's into music, into stuff, that's a dangerous question to ask because they'll just start yakking and might never stop yakking. So I'll try to not go too far into this. Of course, you said that this is going to be audio, not
Right.
visual, but I can see you and you can see me. So I'm just going to reach over to my record shelf and show you a couple of things here.
Oh, all right.
Okay, I'm back. So I guess if I had to pick a crown jewel or two, I'll preface this by saying that my rule for buying records for a long time has always been never spend more than $15 on a record. So, and my sort of specialty, the majority of my collection is like 60s psychedelic stuff, 60s weird stuff, garage rock, psychedelic. And that is a increasingly difficult realm to find records for $15 or less, but I like that challenge. And I don't mind if I'm buying a reissue also or whatever. I just want to find something interesting for $15 or less. And I've broken that rule a very few times when I was like, it just seemed like I had to, but really less than a handful of times. But this is one of my crown jewels. This is the first Fugs record from 1965. This is the first original edition of the first Fugs record back when it was called the Village Fugs. I think it only existed in this original form for a very brief time before they signed to the ESP label, and this album was reissued as the Fugs' first album. And most of the time you see this, it's called the Fugs' first album. It has a slightly different album cover. It even has some slightly different recordings on the record. There's different takes of a few songs that are on that other version versus this version. I did get this for $15, and one of the best things about it is that I bought it on the street. Some guy was selling records just on the sidewalk on St. Mark's Place in New York City, and that's where the Fugs would have been playing basically all their gigs in 1965 when this album came out. So I love the fact that somebody probably saw the Fugs play on that block in 1965, bought this record when it first came out during the brief time that this original edition existed, probably had that record in their apartment for, whatever, 55 years, 50 years, 45, however many decades. And then somebody was just selling those records right on that sidewalk on that same block, and I walked along to purchase it. So it just, the place and the time and that historical element of it just make, and plus this is a record that I very much wanted for a long time. It's sort of a holy grail record for me. First edition of the first Fugs record, one of my favorite albums. And then because I ended up at a certain point in my life, I became buddies with Thule Kufferberg, who was in the Fugs. When he died back in 2010, his girlfriend Thelma was giving people locks of his hair because she would always cut his hair. That was like part of their relationship. So she had like collected a bunch of Thule Kufferberg's hair. So I actually have a lock of Thule's hair tucked into this record. So not only is this the first edition of the first Fugs record bought on St. Mark's Place, where it probably had just been stashed away for all those decades, it even has a lock of Thule's hair tucked into it. So this is one of my, yeah, if I had to run out of a burning building and grab a couple of records, this is probably one that I would reach for.
Well, that's a pretty darn good answer, I gotta say, Jeffrey. Very cool story. A cosmic connection. The Fugs record makes it back to where it started. I guess last question, then we'll play a song, and then we'll come back and we'll do some news. We'll give Jeffrey a little bit of a break. Jeffrey, what's one thing or the main thing or anything that you would like the listener to take from the new record?
Wow. I guess what I would like anybody to take from any of my records, but from the new record, is I would like somebody to say, "This is the most incredible thing I've ever heard in my life, and I'm throwing out everything that I've ever owned and only buying Jeffrey Lewis records, and where has this been all my life? And let me just go to all of Jeffrey's gigs and blah, blah, blah." Because, when you're an artist, you make stuff and you feel really great about it, and it would be nice if somebody else felt as great about it as you feel about it. But I think the creative longevity of it, like I was talking about earlier, I think the idea that an artist is only important or creative when they're young, and that for most artists, if you're trying to get somebody into a certain artist, I think for a lot of artists, you would say, "Here, listen to their first record, listen to their first couple records." But I would like to think of myself as somebody that if you were trying to get somebody into my stuff, you might just as well say, "Here, listen to his 10th album. Listen to the new one, because this is like maybe the best one he's ever done, or it's one of the best ones he's ever done." And there's a handful of artists that I think of in that category, where if I was recommending their work to somebody, I wouldn't necessarily say get their first album. I would say, "Here, get this one from like 20 years into their career, because they actually were getting better all that time. They weren't just recycling or kind of living off of the fumes of what they had initially done. They kept on working and trying to push the creative boundaries of what they could do." Or I don't know, if I think of Lou Reed or I think of The Fall, some of my favorite artists, I think some of their later records are some of their better ones, and that's a nice hopeful perspective as any artist, whether you're a painter or a poet. It's very depressing to think that you're just going to get worse as you get older. So I really idolize the very small handful of artists that, continue to make work that I like, even into their later years. So I think I would like somebody to listen to my new record and be like, "Whoa, this is just as good or better as anything he made 10, 20 years ago." And I kind of think it is. I feel like I couldn't have made a record this good back then. I look at some of the older records I made and I'm like, "Wow, I've come a long way. I'm glad I'm making this record now. I couldn't have done this then."
Well, Jeffrey certainly is getting better all the time. The new record, the even more freewheeling Jeffrey Lewis, out via Don Giovanni, March 21. It's freaking great. We're going to play a song from that, and then we'll be right back. And the track that we're going to play is Just Fun, and we'll be right back.
Try to see your parents more, cause they're so weak and old now. But they just can't let you live without always being told how. Then spend time with your child, be responsible and silent. But you lose it, then you know that you're a monster and a tyrant. It's family, so you call, because you're too grown up to fume. But somehow you've hung up and thrown the phone across the room. Cause you're a weakling and a loser, you just never get it right. Down from the way that you were raised to how your own home is tonight. These are the ones you love the best, so why is it always such a mess? And what the hell's it for, since you're rotten to the core? Well, it's fun. It's just fun. Pick out someone friendly who romantically excites you. Start the hopeful dreaming of what if he or she likes you. Know that you could love them and build up a blissful fantasy that this is finally something and how good your lives would be. But then feel wretched when it's clear it's just your far-fetched dumb idea. Remember that you're lame and ugly, groan and cry. Why would they love me? Why even try to cope? And why even have hope? You're disgusting, that's for sure. So what's hoping for? Well, it's fun. It's just fun. Know your only joy would be a life of creativity, so never have a moment when you're actually at liberty. Live a life where friends or relaxation leaves you irking, cause it's wasting time with nonsense when you know you should be working. First see your glowing promise as an actor or a painter, then get honest, you're a hack who knows their glow is getting fainter. Then know your life's been total dirt and wish you could begin again, then crumple one more worthless work and toss it in the bin again. You hung your head against the desk and suffered in the agony of coming face to face against that stuff that you can never be. It's lame and infantile, all this stupid, useless trial, frustrations and impatience and complete humiliations. You're just not fortunate, that's certain, so why this tortured, screaming burden? Well, it's fun. It's just fun.
And we are back, and we're going to hit some news. And I'm very curious to Jeffrey's opinion, but we're going to give him a little bit of a break because I'm going to hit M first. M, Scow has now released the third track from this is the third track, right?
Yeah, this is the third one.
The third single from the album, Are We All Angels? And of course, as listeners know, all eyes are on Scow. They started out as a hardcore band. Everyone loved them. Then they put out the Psychic Dancer Teen album, which was kind of punk, kind of alt rock, kind of grunge. Then they put out the remix of Psychic Dancer Teen, which was a dance track. And now they've got their second for real deal album coming out. The first track kind of caught a lot of people by surprise, including myself, because it was new medley. The second one was kind of more punky. And this one is I would say, pop punky, perhaps, or maybe even poppy. It's called Babe. I dug it a lot. It definitely seems like the new Scow record is going to have a lot of different facets, a lot of different sounds, which I think is cool. And I thought this track was good. I thought this track was good. Actually, I thought it was real good. But I am still waiting, M, for the single of the album to totally blow me away. What did you think of Babe? Although, I will say, Kat Moss, the singer, she's an awesome singer, but she's also an awesome lyricist. I love her abstract and her very poetic lyrics, especially when they're applied to a hardcore or even just a punk sound. So, Em, what did you think of this track?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. Her vocal dynamics are like nuts. The the harsh and clean like switching is just like seamless, and it's so good. I thought it definitely has more of a poppy vibe. There's still the alt rock thing, and there's still like hardcore. Like, it's kind of blending everything that they've done up to this point. I also went back and listened to Special and Not Hell, Not Heaven, and then this one in sequence as it is on Bandcamp. Special deserves a re-listen because
It's new medley, M. It's new medley.
But listen to it against the other stuff.
All right, I will.
So I think that's what they're trying to do. Like, they're trying to take all their influences and really put you off center. You know, like, you don't know what's going to come next. You don't know, like, kind of what their sound's going to be. So I'm really excited for this album. I think it's going to be great.
Jeffrey, are you following Scow? Is a Scow a new to you band? And did you check out this track at all?
No, this is all when you said it's news. It's certainly news to me because I'm totally ignorant of most things of the 21st century. So if we were talking about something that came out 40, 50, 60 years ago, I'd be all over it. But once it crosses into the 21st century, it's I'm like an old grandpa who's like, how do you use the remote control on the VCR? That's the extent of what I can participate in this conversation with.
Okay, well, here's a story about someone from back in the day. This is actually pretty sad, but then we got a happy story after this. David Johansen, perhaps the greatest punk singer / rock singer of all time. Certainly one of the architects of one of the greatest bands of all time, and certainly one of the architects of one of the greatest albums of all time, if not the greatest album of all time. Sadly, he's got stage 4 cancer. Not only that, he fell down around New Year's Day or New Year's Eve or something, and so he's been bedridden since then, and things are looking pretty rough for him. They've got not a GoFundMe, but kind of a donation thing that you can donate to. And so actually I haven't, but I'm actually about to throw in a couple of bucks. I think New York Dolls to me, and even David Joe Solo, which is great, I think it's all super great. And I think, if all the fans just threw in a little bit of money, it probably would help him out a whole lot. I'm sorry to see him in such the shape that he's in. I don't know how it's going to wind up. I wish him all the best. So, I mean, I really only have two comments in that. A, New York Dolls get a fair amount of respect. but they don't get quite the level of respect they should get. I mean, like, I love the Stooges. To me, New York Dolls are equal to the Stooges, equal to the Ramones, equal to Black Flag, equal to any of those bands, New York Dolls, or maybe even better. New York Dolls are an absolutely amazing, mind-blowing band, and I'm sorry to see that the last surviving New York Doll is in rough shape right now. I don't know if you have any perspective on the New York Dolls or David Joe sadly being sick. He's still doing his radio show, which kind of blows me away. I guess he really does love the radio show, which his radio show, if you haven't checked it out, is super great. He plays stuff from all over the map. He has really interesting comments. Sometimes he tells some of his wild stories from, you know, New York 70s and 80s and that kind of thing. So, Em, I don't know if you have any, I mean, there's not a whole lot to comment here, but I don't know if you have any perspective on the New York Dolls or Dave Johansson in general.
Yeah, New York Dolls were one of the bands when I was getting into punk and I was looking into kind of like, oh, well, this band was influenced by this band, and, you know, like kind of working backwards. They were one that really stuck out and one that like I've listened to a ton. I had like I've had pins and like different things. Absolutely amazing band. I agree. They should be given more credit. This is really sad. This really, you know, I hope he pulls through. And it's really good that he has the radio show. He has something that he's doing that he obviously like loves, is really passionate about. And that's, you know, kind of all you can ask for, because that'll help in one way or another. So I wish him nothing but the best.
Not to make it all about me, but he did like 10 or 15 or even 20 shows in like Long Island, and they were billed as Buster Poindexter. And I actually like Buster Poindexter, and I would have went up there, but it was like $150, and it's like, for me, that's like a 5-hour, 4-hour drive. So you're looking at about $500, $600, and I'm like, I'm not going to go. And apparently he was doing New York Dolls, David Joe solo, and Buster Poindexter, and it was for that Scorsese documentary. And now I'm like really kicking myself for not going. It's like, ugh. I guess the takeaway there is seize the moment while you can. Jeffrey, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but being that you're a New York guy, I would think you'd be a big New York Dolls fan. Are you or are you not? Or where do you stand?
No, I love those records as much as the next guy. And I was certainly surprised and sad to hear that news when I saw that online, because that sounds very rough. And he's not that old. I mean, yeah. There's a lot of people out there who, you know, you think of, I don't know, Mick Jagger and Paul McCartney and all these people who are of an earlier generation that are still out there. And you would expect to hear that they're sort of reaching the end. But it was a shock to hear that David Johansen is in such rough shape currently. And I did see, I've never seen, well, no, that's not true. I did see the New York Dolls play live once. It was a thing, an outdoor thing at Coney Island. And I saw him in the audience at a Jonathan Richman gig not that long ago. This was maybe a year ago. And I think he had an eye patch on. I couldn't even tell if it was just a fashion statement. He looked cool as hell, and it was like, oh my God, I think that's David Johansen. and the fact that he was at a Jonathan Richman show was super cool. I thought that was just awesome that he would be down with that. And actually Ernie Brooks was there too, the original Modern Lovers bass player. I just noticed these folks in the crowd. I've got some of those David Johansen solo records, and I think that they're pretty underrated. I was glad to hear you mention them, because nobody ever talks about those albums the way that they talk about the Johnny Thunders stuff. Johnny Thunders, after the New York Dolls, his post-New York Dolls stuff is so much more legendary, whereas these David Johansen records, I just sort of pick them up when I see them for like $1 or $2. They're really not held in very high regard, it seems to me, but I was very happily surprised when I took some of those records home and started listening to them. I was like, huh, this is really good stuff. There's some really great songs on there. So yeah, that's sad news to hear, but I had no idea that he had that radio show, and that he, so that's cool to hear about. I would like to check that out.
It's called The Mansion of Fun. It's on Sirius XM, and it's super good. It really is a treasure trove. And as Jeffrey says, the David Joe solo records, especially the first one and the live records. There's one called Live It Up and another one just called David Johansen Live, which originally was a promo, but they re-released as a double album. And they're both, the live albums are super good. And the first studio record and all the studio records are real good. Let's do a kind of a happy story here, though. Patti Smith, celebrating 50th anniversary of Horses. She's going on tour. She's got about 20 dates, maybe 10 in the USA or so. Maybe actually a little bit more than 10, maybe 15 dates in the USA, including Philadelphia, New York, of course, Boston, Chicago, LA, San Francisco. And she's going to do all of Horses and probably some other tracks. She's doing that cool thing on like – Patti Smith is cool as hell. I'll tell a couple quick Patti Smith stories. I saw Patti Smith the first time about 2 years ago. It was at one of these weird radio rock festivals. It was Patti Smith and Shinedown, I think. And I'm like, Shinedown? I'm like, I wouldn't think the draw of Shinedown would be like six people. But sure enough, like at this radio rock festival, there was tens. And by, I mean, like there's probably about 30,000 people there to see Shinedown. I couldn't believe there's so many Shinedown t-shirts. And Patti Smith was not getting nearly the fan base that Shinedown of all people was, which kind of blew me away. But at any rate, it was in Camden, New Jersey. And of course, Patti Smith used to live in Camden briefly for a year or something. And she loves Walt Whitman, and Walt Whitman lived in Camden. And she comes out and she starts reading like Walt Whitman poetry. And she loves it so much that she starts like crying. Like she loves Walt Whitman so much, she's crying about how much she loves Walt Whitman, which I thought was the greatest thing ever, because Patti Smith is a total weirdo in the best way. And then she started playing like some hits, some rarities, some covers. Of course, she did Free Money. She did Redondo Beach. She did Gloria. She did Horses. She did Pissing in the River. She did Because of the Night. And she was absolutely amazing. Patti Smith friggin' rules on record. She rules live. She was so awesome. So anyway, I'm super psyched to see this Horses tour. I was lucky enough to – I almost got a front row, but I got three rows back. And what do you think? Patti Smith, basically front row cost. What do you think?
Ooh, I'm going to guess $100. I don't
Bam.
Think that's right.
$100 in 2025. Oh, really? I got to say, nice. In 2025, $100, pretty reasonable, I got to say. I mean, in 1997, that'd be pretty expensive, but in 2025, kind of reasonable. And she's doing the thing where you can resell the ticket, but you can only resell what you bought it for, which is, I mean, honestly, oh. I wish a lot of kind of, quote, more punker or bigger punk bands kind of said to Ticketmaster, all right, I'll do a Ticketmaster venue or Live Nation venue, but you have to lock the, because, you know, Ticketmaster makes, Ticketmaster on some shows, including Metallica, Ticketmaster makes more money off the resale than the actual ticket to begin with, which is mind-blowing. And so with Patti Smith, perhaps it's a little bit easier for her to make that demand, because the demand for a Patti Smith show is far less than the demand for a Metallica show, sadly. So Ticketmaster can, to a degree, look like a good guy and say, okay, Patti Smith, we won't let people resell your tickets. But, you know, Sabrina Carpenter or Taylor Swift, they will resell, you know, to whatever, you know. So it's kind of cool that Patti – but that being said, it's kind of cool that Patti Smith kind of made that demand. So I'm super psyched to see this show. And Patti Smith, cool as hell or extremely cool as hell?
The coolest of hell, like just the coolest person ever, honestly. I looked at the dates because, you know, they're all formatted. It's like, oh my God, there's so many and there's no Canadian date.
And you gotta make the trip, Em. You gotta make the trip, Em. This is, I mean, she says she's never gonna do Horses all the way through again. You can make the trip to New York or Chicago, Em. You can do it. You can, or Boston. You can
somewhere.
Do it.
Yeah, like to see this, it would be so worth it. Like, again, she's on my kind of my list. All timeless. Like, she'd be just incredible to see, and Horses would be so cool. Like, ugh, yeah.
Jeffrey, are you a Patti Smith fan? And do you like full album shows, or do you find full album shows kind of overdone and not exciting because you know what you're going to get?
I gotta say, yeah, not to piss on the enthusiasm, because I love the enthusiasm, but the full album show concept is not my thing. I don't like that thing, because I love being at a show and you hear the first notes of the next song and you say, oh my God, I can't believe they're playing this. Or from song to song, you just don't know what's going to happen. And that excitement and that on the edge of your seat and that sense of just the best parts of a gig are where the band pulls out something you weren't expecting them to, and that level of mind-blowingness, I think, is probably not there in a gig where you know everything you're going to get. I can understand there. Well, of course, there is an excitement when an artist does a whole record because there's probably songs they don't do live that often, and now they're forced to be like, oh, damn, we're doing this record, but here's a couple of songs in this record. We haven't actually played in 40 years. So that's kind of cool that it kind of makes them maybe pull out some deep cuts. By definition, the deep cuts are the ones that are on the record that don't often get played. So that's a good thing. I mean, there is nothing on this earth that's more awesome than Birdland. So that track alone would make any experience worthwhile. Of course, knowing you're going to get it, I think, is not as exciting as being at a Patti Smith show and then you hear those first couple chords and you're like, holy cow, I can't believe it. They're actually going to play this song. But like you're saying about seeing David Johansen, have, you know, missing that opportunity to see him, all of these artists, in fact, at any artist at any age, you don't know when you might be seeing them again. And even if it's not their last tour, they may not be in as good a form further on. I mean, I've seen gigs. I got to see Rocky Erickson 3 times, and I must say the first time I saw him was one of the best shows I've ever seen. And then the second and third time I saw him, the third time was actually shortly before he died. But even that second time I saw him, it was like he was already a little too far gone to be as awesome, even though he lived about another 10 years after that point. I'm really glad that I saw that first show of his that I saw, because I feel like I really caught him at a level of engagement and greatness that seeing him later, it's like he's still the legend, but you know, artists aren't always in peak form up until the very end of their life. So see everybody now, I guess, is always the rule. And that's the case for, you know, if you get a chance to see Jonathan Richman, if you get a chance, you know, these people are not going to be around forever, and they are at a level of artistic awesomeness that no, you know, it's unique. You know that you're getting something that is a very special thing.
And actually, I'm gonna bend the conversation back around real quick. Is on the new record, Jeffrey, I get like thanks on the record. You like thank your lucky stars, or you wish upon the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. You say like Brian Jones and Charlie Watts. And you mentioned how they're still kicking along. Rolling Stones, my favorite band ever. I saw them about 6 months ago now, and they were totally awesome still, even sadly without Charlie. But I'm just curious, Jeffrey. Stones are like my favorite band. What do the Stones mean to you? What's your Rolling Stones album pick?
Oh gosh. Well, yeah, I would put them in my top three favorite bands. Maybe my top. Let It Bleed would probably be my top album pick if I had to pick one. And sure, I mean, if you love the Rolling Stones, how can you not love the New York Dolls? It's like those are the records the Stones should have been making in the 70s. And it's yeah, I don't know. Well, how much do we want to start talking about the Stones? That's a whole other conversation.
Fair enough. So we're coming near the end. We'll blast through, I guess, one last story, and then we'll wrap it on up. Of course, Jeffrey, thanks for being on the show. Last story, back to the records. Record Store Day is coming down the block again. The last couple of Record Store Days have been, I would say, relatively weak. Some people are pro Record Store Day, some people are anti. I'm pro Record Store Day just because I like at Record Store Day that even though prices are inflated, it is a chance where stuff that would never get normally released does get released. Some of the classic examples would be the slew of live Alice Cooper records that came out, particularly the one Alice Cooper live in 82 during the Special Forces tour, which was super cool. They put out a bunch of, I guess, obscure Sublime tracks a couple of different years, which were very cool. This year, Ramones are reissuing Loco Live, which I want to talk about in a second. Judas Priest are releasing Live in 82, which was released on CD in their massive, massive 100 CD box set. Talking Heads are releasing a live record from the first album. Ice-T's putting out a compilation of the 12-inch singles from Power. Rage Against the Machine is putting out an unreleased live record. Lou Reed is re-releasing Metal Machine music. And of course, maybe another greatest band of all time, the Dwarves, are releasing Sunshine, Lollipop, and Rainbows, which is the tracks from the Blood Guts album recorded in a single take before they actually went into the studio to record Blood Guts. Apparently, it sounds a lot different than the Blood Guts album. It's in a deluxe gatefold picture sleeve, and it looks super cool to me. I'm extremely psyched about that. I'm going to comment on the Ramones real briefly, and we've sort of discussed this on the podcast before, in that for a while, the Ramones, even though Linda and Mickey Lee hate each other, for a while they were working together to put out some really, really cool stuff. They put out the 80s records box set. They put out the Live on New Year's Eve live album. They put out the rough mix of rough mix of Brain Drain, was it, or what rough mix of one of the album, which was significantly different than the album version. And so they were putting out a bunch of really cool stuff. Then they sued each other over the Pete Davidson movie that's probably never going to come out. And last Record Store Day, they just put out a generic greatest hits record. And of course, Mickey Lee sold his share of Joey Ramone's publishing. No, I'm wrong about that. He sold a share of the publishing, but he also sold a share of the Ramones production company, which means Linda Ramone is now dealing with a production company. And also, so now that they're re-releasing Loco Live, which is a hard-to-find-on-record Ramones album. It's not a rare Ramones record or unreleased record like we were seeing before, but I would say it's a step up. That being said, I am somewhat saddened, and that appears the golden age of unreleased Ramones archival material appears to be over. So, any comment on any of these Record Store Day releases? Are you pro Record Store Day? Are you anti? Do you think we will ever see any more super rare Ramones stuff, or is it just going to be reissue from here on out?
I do not collect records. I appreciate records, and I appreciate what Record Store Day does. If it gets people into like local record stores, I think that's really, really sick. I was trying to look really quick to see if there was something kind of going on at one local to me, but I couldn't find it. I'm sure they are, so go check them out. They're called Emissions Records, and they're in Toronto, and they have a lot of punk and metal and like really cool stuff. But yeah, with the list of releases, Local Live's gonna like be cool, the Talking Heads thing, the Rage Against the Machine thing, and then I was looking through too, and there is a live 1976 Joni Mitchell one, and that is gonna be crazy. Like, that one's gonna be really cool. So yeah, for Ramon stuff, I think there's still stuff floating around. I think we're gonna see something at some point. I don't think we're going to see the volume that we did, and I think all of them from this point out are going to be a little bit more contentious, but I think there's still water in the well, so to speak.
Well said. And I forgot to mention also, Dictators are re-releasing DFFD, their long forgotten 90s record, which actually totally kicks ass and opens with one of their best songs ever, Who Will Save Rock and Roll. Jeffrey, last comment of the day, Record Store Day. Are you pro Record Store Day? Are you excited about anything on the release? And is the Dwarves record going to be the best release of Record Store Day or the very best release of the Record Store Day?
I'm not a Record Store Day guy. In some ways, my rule of never spending more than $15 on a record puts it a little bit out of my realm. I think that some of these releases are cool and exciting, and if I see a secondhand copy for under $15, I might snap them up. I remember hearing that there was a Record Store Day release at some point of like the original mix of the first Stooges record, like John Cale's first mixes that were supposedly pretty different. And I was very curious about what that might sound like. I'm sure there's probably cool stuff out there. And if it gets people more interested in music in general and gets people interested in poking beyond the surface of the fact, you know, and sort of learning that there's some incredible artifacts and things out there that are maybe some of the most exciting things that you will have ever encountered if you just dig a little deeper. I think there's always value in that, but I've just never noticed or paid attention to what is coming out on Record Store Day. And I'm I'm a record store addict. They certainly don't need to convince me to go into a record store. If anything, I need a 12-step program to stay away from record stores. So, I'm unlikely to be found at a record store day event.
Well, as Jeffrey says it, every day is record store day if you're in the records. Jeffrey, I'm not to chew you off, and I will let you go in 1 second, but what are, just briefly, what are some of your favorite record stores?
I can't tell you because you would get there before me and snap up all the
Fair
things that
enough,
I would
fair enough.
otherwise have found. So
A real
I have to
competitor.
keep that information a closely guarded secret.
Well put, Jeffrey, thank you for coming on the show. Before we wrap this up, anything you want the listeners to know? The new record, the even more freewheeling Jeffrey Lewis out March 21 on Don Giovanni. It's real cool. Check it out. Some of the tracks are streaming right now. We played some on the show. Jeffrey, anything else you want the listeners to know?
What I would like the listeners to know. Well, I just really appreciate what you're doing, and I think it's great that both of you, John and Em, I just love listening to the enthusiasm and the tremendous knowledge that you guys have. I feel like I would just sit in a room happily and listen to the two of you talk, and I guess that's what radio is all about. I do get to just sit and listen to the two of you talk. So, great job, and all that love and passion that you folks have for all of that music really comes through, and it just makes me feel great just to hear you guys.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey. And
Thank you.
just as Jeffrey is Crass approved, we are Jeffrey Lewis approved. Once again, Jeffrey Lewis, the even more freewheeling Jeffrey Lewis, March 21. And this is Relaxation, and we will see you next week.
Relaxation is my nemesis, I'm not a nihilist, that's just how I exist. Relaxation's the destroying choice in which I'd have no voice, and I avoid like poison, because relaxation's not a motivation, it's disintegration, it's annihilation, an evil twin I'm not believing in, and I'm not giving in, cause it's oblivion. Relaxation is just television, where they sell a vision, that's not my decision. Relaxation isn't in my interest, to be gone in splinters like atomic winters. Cause if I'd relax, you'd slip me with an axe, you'd roll me off your backs, I'd last an hour max. If I dared slow down before I turned around, you'd roll me through the ground, I'd have no face or sound. So relaxation's not a nice vacation, it's the swift invasion, force the world's impatient, for it's not my friend, just my brutal end, and I cannot give in, cause it's oblivion. Relaxation is a prize they offer, then they pry me off and hide me in a coffin. Because relaxation means you'd all be leaving, I'd be hurt and freezing, murdered for no reason. Relaxation's just a worm they bait me with to earn the faithlessness they burn to hate me with. If I stop sweating, you'd make sure I'm getting just some last bloodletting, then a fast beheading. And I'd tumble quickly and I'd cry out sickly, but you'd all be gone before the lights came on. It's a fatal sin the way it's always been, so I cannot give in, cause it's oblivion. If I relaxed the shield, I left my back revealed, you split me right in half, you'd spill my guts and laugh, so I'd be dead if lazy, though you said I'm crazy, it'd be suicide, you know it's true inside. So relaxation's not a nice vacation, when the world's just waiting for your violation. An evil twin I'm not believing in, and can't be living in, so I'm not giving in. It's not what I'd intend, I'd lie if I'd pretend, so though I'll never win, whichever rides begin, roll my eyes again, and guard my sides again. Relaxing makes me tense, because it's violence, and that's where relaxation is my nemesis, on their retired list, it's not how I'd exist. Relaxation's not a motivation, it's disintegration, it's annihilation. It's not anything but where the end begins, and I cannot give in, cause it's oblivion. It'd be suicide, I know it's true inside, so I cannot give in, cause it's oblivion.